History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. And they don't have to go untold. A little intentionality goes a long, long way, doesn't it? We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And of course, we're always educated in the process. We're entertained for sure, and we almost always find ourselves inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. I'm not sure how you spent America's 250th birthday last weekend or how many fireworks you witnessed, but the best fireworks photo I saw anywhere came from Washington, D.C., where our friends from the Best Defense Foundation captured video and still photos of 11 World War II veterans silhouetted at the National World War II Memorial. They were all watching the fireworks lighting up the sky in the distance. A few of those veterans drew special recognition from the Commander-in-Chief and had the privilege of saluting three historic flags from World War II.
Ken Shubring was 19 years old when he survived the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor. After enemy planes sank ships like the USS Arizona, he resolved that he would help America strike back and win. He wanted them to strike back and win. Flying B-29s in the Pacific, Ken fought from the first day to the very last. He was in the war right from the first day, and he went to the last day and all the way to the enemy's unconditional surrender. We got an unconditional surrender. He was there at 104 years old and looking really good. Captain Shubring is here tonight, and he is saluting the flag that went down with the Arizona at Pearl Harbor, but was raised back up with the help of some unbelievable American patriots. It's a symbol of American defiance, please. On D-Day in World War II, Navy Lieutenant Arthur Rose commanded 36 landing craft as part of the largest naval armada in history. Recalling that sight, he wrote home to his parents, "What a country we are." At 107 years old, Lieutenant Rose is here to salute one of our nation's most prized possessions, the flag that flew aboard the first landing craft on D-Day and led the first Americans onto the beaches of Normandy to liberate Europe and defeat Nazi fascism forever. Lieutenant Rose, you are an inspiration to this beautiful crowd, and we thank you very much. Amazing man. 107. It's 107. On Iwo Jima in the Pacific, the Marines faced some of the most brutal combat in the history of warfare. They shed their blood for every inch of mountain that they reached. And when they reached the summit and raised the stars and stripes for all to see, it was so special to everybody there. Everybody there and everybody watching. They couldn't believe it. It wasn't supposed to happen. With us today is one of the last survivors of that battle, 101-year-old Marine Corporal Don Graves. And he's here to salute that famous flag he saw rise in the glory of Iwo Jima 81 years ago. And you've all seen that flag many times. So, ladies and gentlemen, these are the fighters and the banners of the greatest generation. They are the greatest generation. I hate to admit that, but they are. They saved the world, and they made America very, very proud. We're very proud of you, heroes all.
Those flags they saluted were from Pearl Harbor, from Normandy, and from Iwo Jima. And the president mentioned a brief quote from a letter Arthur Rose, now 107 years old, had written to his family right after he participated in the D-Day landing. But I bet you haven't heard the rest of that letter. When Mr. Rose visited Normandy for the 82nd anniversary of D-Day last month with the Best Defense Foundation, He actually stood in the rain there in France and at 107 years old, read that letter he had penned when he was just 25.
June 11th, 1944. Dear Mom and Dad and kids, about a month after we landed, I had a feeling I might be part of the invasion. I kept thinking that what could I possibly do in an invasion? Pull engines in the middle of a battle? Change injectors after the smoke, the wreckage damage had passed? But 2 weeks before D-Day, I was told I would go along and do whatever I could. We had moved to the assault port, thousands of ships, landing craft of every description, filled the harbor, and everyone worked day and night preparing fuel, provisions, ammunition parts, secret material, everything checked and rechecked and checked again. You can't imagine the confusion and activity. Then came the day we began loading supplies for the invasion. We knew then the invasion could not be far. Then came the word. D-Day will be June. I probably can't describe the feeling exactly. It wasn't fear, and it wasn't excitement, just a funny feeling in the stomach. Nervousness, expectancy, and wondering what was going to happen next. Then we sailed. The sea was rough, windy, and miserable. I was seasick most of the time. Everyone expected bombing, submarines, battleships, and all hell to break loose at any moment. But the first attempt was called off. Oh, I remember that. Because the sea was too rough. And we returned to the harbor. That was a real letdown. The next day, we sailed again near the coast of France. We could see flashes in the distance and hear explosions continuously. In went the landing craft. We expected terrible destruction. There was shelling, yes. Men died, but not Holocaust we had imagined. Back and forth, day and night, and they had once been just another stretch of French coast had suddenly become a vast harbor filled with hundreds of ships and thousands of men. I don't remember writing this. I will always be grateful to my commander taking me along. Don't worry about me. I am well and whole and happy. Love, Art.
Arthur Rose, now 107 years old. And you've heard us talk about the Best Defense Foundation on this program before. You've heard multiple times from the organization's founder, the former NFL All-Pro linebacker Donnie Edwards, who was inspired by his World War II grandfather. If you would like to support the great work that Donnie and his wife Catherine and that amazing group are doing now, not just with World War II vets, but with veterans of all ages, go to bestdefensefoundation.org. It's time for our first break, but when we come back, this weekend marks a World War II anniversary that you didn't hear anything about in the president's remarks, and you may not have heard anything about ever. But it was an invasion that many of those who would land on those beaches on June 6, 1944, had already participated in nearly a year earlier. Lessons were learned that would influence Operation Overlord, but lives were lost as well. Have you figured out which operation I'm talking about? Well, we're going to hear about it from someone who survived it when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. Hey, do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for way too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I gotta tell you, when it comes to your money, I think I've found a better way with EECU. Just take a look at myeecu.org and I think you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a not-for-profit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Over 350,000 members now in 12 different California counties and access to more than 30,000 co-op ATMs and free online and mobile banking. What I love most is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. A decade ago, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. By the end of this year, more than 2,000 veterans will have visited their memorials for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement that EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 1-800-538-3328.
Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. When we left off, I mentioned a World War II anniversary, an operation that often gets overlooked because of the bigger, more attention-grabbing landings later. But 83 years ago this weekend, starting with July 10th, 1943, 150,000 troops, 4,000 aircraft, and 3,000 Allied ships all participated in Operation Husky, the invasion of Sicily. If you've seen that new movie Pressure about the meteorological considerations that altered history when it comes to the Normandy invasion, you might be interested to know that Operation Husky was almost canceled because of a summer storm that caused big problems for paratroopers dropping in behind enemy lines the night before. But as it turns out, that bad weather actually gave the enemy a false sense of security. Axis leaders didn't think anyone would be crazy enough to attempt amphibious landings on Sicily's southern shores in that kind of wind and rain. But that's exactly what happened. General George Patton landed with the U.S. 7th Army, while to the east of that group, General Montgomery and the British came ashore. The Germans had thought any attack would come through Corsica or Sardinia, not Sicily, and thus they only had two divisions there on the island to oppose the Allies. Sicily would turn into a significant Allied victory, but it did come at the cost of nearly 3,000 American lives over 38 days. One man who came close to adding to that number was Jerry Countess. Later in the war, he would earn the Silver Star as well as the Purple Heart. But Jerry was always convinced Sicily was the closest he ever came to losing his life. He wrote a book called Letters from the Battlefield in Love and War. It centered around his connection to a nurse named Rachel.
We were close together for a year or two. She went to Brooklyn College at night, as I did. I lived on this side of town. She lived over here. I drove my bicycle across town to her. We walked from there to back to her house, which was another mile or two. And we stayed out together until 12, 1 o'clock at night. And then I had a ride back by bike all the way across Brooklyn to the other side. But I didn't care. I was happy. I was also young.
Yeah.
My thighs were like that, solid iron. At any rate, we did that. And then when I got in the Army, she got word that she was accepted for the Barnett Memorial Hospital in New Jersey, Patterson, New Jersey. When I heard that she had gotten into that school and I knew I was going overseas, I knew that if I didn't do something quick about seeing her, we weren't going to see each other, possibly never. So me and two other guys who were in the regular Army went AWOL on a Saturday morning. We got a train, which was a six-hour ride to New York, but we got a train. We went to New York. These two guys went out and had a great time for the weekend. I saw her. She said, oh, I had to go to the school where she was in Patterson, New Jersey. I went there. I found her. Everybody was looked at me in an Army uniform. What the hell are you doing there? But I found her, and I proposed to her, and I said, okay, let's get married. We have a weekend. And she said, no, I don't want to be a widow before I'm a wife. She said, for me, marriage is something serious. I'm not going to do this for a one-night stand.
Mm-hmm.
I understood. I wasn't happy, but I understood what she said. I said, okay. And we kissed, and I got back into Manhattan. I got on the train at Penn Station, and I went back down to where it was. The train went down about 3 hours, no problem. And then suddenly the train stopped, was moved over onto a siding. Nobody knew why. We sat for over 2 hours until another train coming up from the south had to go past us. They had to have the open road to go. Mm-hmm. So they went past us, and then we got back on. The train went back on the road. But I arrived back at Fort Lee, which is where I was at, 2 hours after Reveille in the morning.
Uh-oh.
That is precisely what. So I thought, well, you know, they won't let me take a weekend off, which is what one of the forms of punishment that they gave you. Well, you know, if you're sitting in an army barracks and you couldn't go away for the weekend, it was no fun. So me and the other two guys went in. The two army guys got 30 days. They couldn't leave the barracks. I got 30 days in jail.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know what jail was, but it was just a small building. It wasn't a regular big jail, and you couldn't get out of the building. However, they gave you a job. You couldn't just sit in the jail. My job was to go out with the cleanup detail every morning. The truck went around the area and picked up the full barrels of waste from every one of the barrels.
The honey buckets.
Threw them into the truck.
Yeah.
Well, I thought it was going to be terrible, but it turned out not to be quite so terrible because all of the dirty stuff was taken somewhere else. So all they had was mail. I went through the mail, and I was sitting in the back of the truck. I dumped it out on the ground, on the back of the truck, and I take up a letter and look at it, and almost all the letters were from females, all the letters to males, and some were pretty juicy. So I read them, and I would tell you, hey, you gotta listen to this one. You got to read this one. Three guys would come up and sit down in the truck while we were riding, and I would read some of that stuff. It became a lot of fun.
And here I'm thinking, okay, you went to go ask the woman you love to marry you. She said no. It cost you your spot in the quartermaster corps. It's going to end up putting you in the infantry on the front lines, but you're having fun while you're in jail.
So far, yeah.
All right.
Except after 2 weeks, suddenly I got pulled out of jail, put back in my barracks, and 3 days later they told me, goodbye, you're going in the army overseas. When we got on the boat, we were given guns. In basic training, we had been given 1908 Springfields.
Mm-hmm.
We did get to shoot 12 shots. That was the training with a gun.
That was the extent of your training, and now you're heading overseas with an infantry division.
When I got overseas, I didn't get a Springfield. We got the brand new M1s.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody told us anything about the guns. Just, here's your gun.
And you told me one of the reasons that you wrote this book, and this book, Letters from the Battlefield in Love and War, it's comprised of letters that you wrote to Ray, who you talked about, who you were in love with, who said she wouldn't marry you before you went overseas, and also to another friend of yours, and there are letters that were written to you as well. And it tells a lot of these stories, but you said one of the reasons you wrote it is you want people to know what it's really like out there. Not necessarily the guts and the glory and the combat, but the day after day of life that changes the way you see your existence.
Well, it was early on. Later on, I was able to write that because I knew, not exactly, but I had lived through the business of what it was like. The first thing you do when you stop walking, the absolute first thing you do, even if you only can stop for 2 or 3 hours, you dig a foxhole. Invariably, the Germans held a higher level, and you fought to take it. When you took it, then you went forward again. You're going down the mountain. You went up a one. They were higher. So they could see, not well, but they could see how many troops there were and what was going on. So if you stopped on a mountain ridge or you stopped in a low place, you were pretty sure that the Germans higher than you were watching you with glasses, telescopes. So you dug a foxhole. I was very lucky. I was short. I could dig a foxhole faster than the tall guys. We all carried the most important instrument, a shovel, about 1.5 feet long, but it had a head about this big. The purpose of that shovel, as soon as you stopped, you reached behind you, uncorked it, and you started digging. If you were lucky, you were digging in sand. But in the mountains, you weren't digging in sand. So digging a foxhole was a very arduous thing.
But that could be the difference between life and death.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. The purpose of a foxhole is to keep you below the level where shrapnel flying this way can't touch you. But if you were out of that foxhole, shrapnel flying at the height of a half a foot or a foot or whatever, you would be touched, seriously.
If I were to say, what was your closest call? Realizing that you're there in North Africa in 1943, then in Italy all the way past Germany's surrender in Europe. So you're over there a long time. I'm sure you had a lot of close calls. What was the moment where you felt you came closest to not coming home and trying to track down that special lady again?
Something that happened when we were attacking the Germans in Sicily. I saved a good part of my company. It had been was not intentional. I didn't know I was going to be doing it. Sicily is a huge collection of mountains, one after another, every way you look. Half of my company went up to the top of a certain area. And my job at that time was, I wasn't a typical fighting soldier. I was like the runner. Mm-hmm. My job was, remember, we didn't have cell phones at that time. we had a phone that was carried on a thing like this, and it worked when you turned the handle. But the battery died quickly. Sometimes it died and you didn't even know it died. It didn't always work, and even when it worked, you weren't sure you were going to get battle headquarters. They went up there, and they were doing their job, you know, fighting the enemy. And all of a sudden, the Germans had new recruitment or whatever. They were really pounding on these people. Unexpectedly, these guys didn't expect to have that many people up there. They were in serious trouble. I had gone up to tell the captain something or whatever that from here, and that's what happened. Oh, my God. You could see stuff flying all over the place. He said, you got to go down and tell them. He said, otherwise, by half an hour from now, we're going to be dead. He said, go down. You're the runner. You know which way to go. You know where the group is. Go get them and tell them. So I ran down that mountain. I have to say, most of the time I wasn't running. I was flying. I jumped going down from one, maybe 20 feet, 15 feet down, landed, fell over, got up, and kept running. It was a nightmare.
With enemy fire coming in the whole time?
Coming in, but not specifically at me. It was coming all over the place.
Sure.
The real danger to that was I could have broken a leg or broken an ankle. That would have been put me into real problems.
Because then you wouldn't have been able to get out.
I wouldn't have been able to get out. And if they took over that, the captain and his crew up there, they were going to come down.
Yep.
And I'd have been up the creek without a paddle.
Yeah.
But, you know, lives of 10, 15, 20 guys are up there. So I had to go. I went down that mountain. I would never do that again in my life. But I was young. I was full of energy and strong. And driven by the necessity, I was more frightened than if they were shooting at me specifically. Just going down because I knew time was of the essence. Mm-hmm. I had to get down there as soon as I can. Or if I got down a long time, they wouldn't be alive.
So you made it in time.
I made it in time. I got the guy. And they had a phone that was working. Not well, but working. They notified the artillery,
mm-hmm.
and the artillery started shooting up at there, and the guys got out. Most of them got out. A few were hurt or wounded, one or two were killed. But basically, most of them got out.
So you made it. You saved their lives in the process. You avoided your life being taken. And here's another thing. You getting hit and killed, obviously, is not the ending you're looking for. But you're being captured could have been equivalent. I've heard a lot of stories from people who were captured by the Germans. If, depending on where you were, if the Germans found out about your Jewish heritage, could have been the end for you.
Yeah, it might have. Absolutely. I'll tell you a story about being captured. This was when I first joined, and I really didn't know very much. Remember, I told you that there were 8 different marching commands. This was maybe 3 or 4 weeks after I joined. We came to a place with a couple of mountains like this. So they gave us the command to march in a straight line, one behind the other. One platoon, 38, 36 guys, 3 or 4 squads. I was in the second squad, and we started to go up the hill. The Germans did something very clever. They stayed on both sides of where we were marching.
Mm.
When we went up, halfway up, they went in this way. What they did is made it impossible for the guys in the back to shoot them because our guys were in the front.
Mm-hmm.
The guys in the front couldn't shoot back. Of course, we were in the back. So these guys took the front group, lock, stock, and barrel. They got them, and we couldn't shoot at them. They took them away. So we lost 15, 14, something number of guys like that.
So if you had been on that half of where the Germans came in?
I'd have been up the creek. At any rate, I just want to finish this story. A year and a half, 2 years later, the war ended. And I was in one of the first guys to be picked to go back home because of the number of different points I had irrelevant. So I got back and I got back on the boat, and there are a couple thousand guys on the boat, and we were very lucky. Instead of the terrible weather we had going back, this was July, the weather was beautiful, the ocean was flat, and so I got on the boat. There were a couple thousand guys in there. Nobody wanted to sleep below. It was impossible. But we stayed up on top of the boat all day. I got to the rail of the boat, and I see some people I know, and we're talking. And I turn around, and I see about 15 feet behind me, there's another small group of guys talking. There's one guy standing there looking at me. We went down, we had lunch, I came back up again, and I go back to the same place, and there's the same guy there, and he's still looking at me. And he smiles. I don't know exactly what he was aiming at, but I didn't say anything. He came over to me. He said, "Hello, Jerry." He says, "You don't remember me?" "No, I don't remember you." He says, "I was in your platoon." Not in your squad, but in your platoon. That is, platoon's 48, 50 people, so four squads, maybe 12 in each one. Mm-hmm. He was in the squad immediately before me on that hill. He was two guys ahead of me, and the line went, the Germans went between us.
Wow.
He was taken to Germany, and he worked in a German factory for almost a full 2 years making tanks.
Wow.
He says, "You can be sure that a lot of those tanks had deficiencies."
Uh-huh. He sabotaged
them. But that's where he was. So, yeah, he and a couple of other people obviously did that. But he spent the entire time that we went through all this crazy stuff, he was in a factory, getting up in the morning, working in the factory all day at night. And I asked him, I said, "Would you rather have been with us instead of in the factory?" He said, "No."
Uh-huh.
I understand. But what a coincidence, you know.
Yeah, and I guess that's a, hey, that could have been me moment.
If they'd have come up a little further, I was two guys away from him.
Mm-hmm. And you were helpless, unable to fire because
couldn't
you would
fire.
Have been hitting
couldn't
your own
fire.
People.
Right.
I know your story has so many twists and turns, and hopefully people listening are intrigued enough that they'll go online at hometownheroesradio.com and find the links to your book, Letters from the Battlefield in Love and War. But I think we can let them know how that story ended. If you have all these letters in this book and you found them somehow. What happened with that young lady you'd asked to marry?
She was working as a nurse in a hospital without any superiors, so they had to do a lot more work. They were working 12 hours a day, 14 hours a day in the hospital. They were the nurses. When she knew she was going home, I knew that I would be going home relatively shortly. I didn't know when. The war ended. I got there. She wasn't there. She had already gone home. They had released her. So I went back to Brooklyn, and I knew the building she lived in. I knew which train went there because that's where I used to go to all the time.
Yeah.
I told her on the phone that I was coming, and when I got there, I got to the apartment house. I was very impressed by the apartment house. It was the only apartment building I'd ever seen that had an elevator in it. She lived on the ground floor. I never used it, but I was very impressed by the elevator. So I finally went down a long hall. I got the door of her house. She had been smart enough to tell her mother and father to take a hike for a while. I got to the door. Couldn't wait. Knocked on the door, rang the bell, no answer. Knocked on the door, rang the bell, no answer. Knocked on the door, and suddenly I heard a voice on the other side. She said, "Yeah, it's me." I said, "Okay, open the door." "No." I said, "Open the door." "No." "Why?" "I can't. It's been too long. I can't. I got so furious. I said, "You know what I'm going to do? I'm going to break that door down. I'm going to back up and go charging at the door. And if I get killed trying to break through that door..." I heard a click. The door was open. Unlocked. And I went in. Out of a clear blue sky, one of her relatives, her older sister, had a husband who was unexpectedly rich. And he decided that he was going to make the marriage for us. And they did it in the basement of his house. They invited about 100 people, all relatives. I had no relatives. I have no sisters, no brothers, no aunts, no uncles, no cousins, nothing. It was just my mother, my grandmother, and me.
Mm-hmm. But all that time that you're overseas, all the times your life could have ended, and again, she'd already said no to you once, but it works out that you come back, you find her again, you marry, you have children and grandchildren, and all these years together. That's pretty amazing, isn't it?
Yeah, I think so. I think I'm one of the luckiest guys alive.
And Jerry Countess believed that till his final breath, which he also remained thankful did not come during the invasion of Sicily, which was unfolding 83 years ago right now. It's time for our final break, but when we come back, remembering a special World War II veteran who just left us at the age of 104. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.
When prices start going up, we all look for ways to save. So here's a simple message for you. Look no further than EECU. Did you know you can finance your mortgage through EECU? How about a home equity line of credit? EECU makes HELOC loans easy. And when the car business is all over the map, the auto loan rates are as steady as can be. EECU is a not-for-profit credit union, not a bank. So the members always win. Go to myeecu.org to become a member today or call 1-800-538-3328.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by Provident Payments, one of the fastest growing payment consultants in America. Connect today at providentpayments.com.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, where with the time we have left, I'd like to honor a member of the greatest generation who left us this week at the age of 104. Out of nearly 16.5 million Americans who served in World War II, a little more than 30,000 remain nationwide. And Clovis, California is mourning the passing of a Navy pilot turned optometrist who made it 4 years past the century mark. Dr. Gilbert Stocks was originally from St. Charles, Arkansas.
I was raised in the Depression, and so when I graduated from high school in 1940, I realized that that was all the education they were going to give me. If I wanted additional education, I was going to have to get it myself. So I got to go to college in Conway, Arkansas, which was Arkansas State Teachers College. I think I started a college, there were less than $100. But luckily, at that time, anybody that finished high school could go to a state college. And maybe that's why I got in, I don't know. But anyway, I went up there. They're going to give me a job of milking cows in the college dairy because I was good at that. I had milked cows at home, so I knew how to do it. I knew which end to work. They had a civilian pilot's training program there that we flew Piper Cubs, and I had always wanted to fly. And when I got there in freshman year, well, I'm going to join. I said, well, you can't join it until you're a sophomore. Well, next year I hightailed it, and I got in. So I was making the flights as well as working in the cafeteria. So they had that in two divisions. They had it in a primary and a secondary. The primary was the Piper Cub, and the secondary was a Waco.
You mentioned that you always wanted to fly. Can you pinpoint or go back to when that developed for you? Was there something that kind of lit that spark for you?
I remember when I saw my first airplane, I was standing outside by our house. It was a little four-room house, and I was about 3, maybe 4 years old. And I heard this zoom, zoom, zoom. What in the world is that? And I happened to look up, and here was this airplane flying across. Couldn't have been over 300 feet. I don't know what he was flying that low for, but he was flying low and slow and just went right straight on across. I don't know where he went. Never heard of him again or anything. He was just passing through. So I said, by golly, I want to fly one of those. And from then on, I was hooked. And all through high school, yeah, I want to fly an airplane. Because one of my play in the Navy band. So that was what we wanted to do. And finally, eventually, that's what we got to do. I was out on a solo flight when I came in, and my instructor says, the Japs bombed Pearl Harbor. I had no idea where Pearl Harbor was. and then told her in Hawaii. Well, I didn't really know where Hawaii was, out in the Pacific someplace, you see. And then I figured, well, that's going to change things, by golly. And for once, I was right.
I'm always fascinated by how people heard that news, because I've heard all kinds of stories of where they were and how that news of Pearl Harbor came to them. So you're actually in the air, you land, and they tell you what's happened.
Yeah.
How did you see that change in things after that?
Well, about that time, the Navy had a program which they called the V-7 program. Now, what that was, if you were a junior in college in good standing, you could get in, or you could take the program and test and see if you could get in flight training. So I wanted to get in it, but said, no, I can't get in it because I was a sophomore. So that went on and was going to sign up, but the government was going to let us finish our school year so I would be a qualified junior. So that's when I got in. So I got this letter from the government giving me 30 days to get in. So I said, oh, gee whiz. I either had the choice of getting in or getting drafted. I ain't going to get drafted if I can get out of it. So there was myself and two other guys. One was Price and the other one was, I can't think of his name. So we decided that, well, we're going to go to the Navy. So we hitchhiked. Back then, you know, traffic wasn't too bad. If you wanted anything, you just about had to hitchhike, especially if you was a student. So we hitchhiked to Little Rock, which is about 75 miles from Conway. And we took the test. And, yeah, we passed the test. Well, that's pretty good. So we're going to send you to New Orleans for additional testing. Oh, okay, because I'd never been to New Orleans. In fact, I'd never been out of the state. So we went down there, and we passed, and then we signed the papers. So from then on, our butts belonged to the Uncle Sam.
And Uncle Sam would send them all over the states, not to mention Okinawa, flying a variety of airplanes. But the most life-changing assignment came when he was sent to Naval Air Station Jacksonville, Florida.
Yes, it was, because that's where eventually I met my wife. That was eventually my wife, the gal that was link trainer. And that was another thing. I hated those things because they worked on the vacuum. And you get in there and you in the dark, you can't see anything but the instruments. Okay, you want to make a standard two needle turn to the left. Okay, you turn a little to the left, nothing happens. Now, you turn a little more, nothing happens. Well, pretty soon that vacuum kicks in and boom, you've got a four needle turn instead of a two. And I used to hate that thing for that reason. And it is just...
And a lot of people listening don't even know what a link trainer is. Well, this is, you know, long before we had these computerized flight simulators they train on today.
Yeah, they've got them now. They're better than the airplane themselves. Yeah.
But not back then. So tell me the story. And you're not the first pilot, by the way, who I've met who married his link trainer instructor. It's interesting how these parallels form. But tell me about that. How did you meet her? What was your first impression? And what gave you the chutzpah to think you might be able to marry this link trainer instructor?
Well, then back there at my age, women was my second thing that I did in the Navy besides flying. It was flying and then women. So I can't tell you. It's just one of those things. I just don't know.
It just seemed like a potentially life-changing moment or a twist of fate that you ended up there while she was there.
Yeah.
Because you could have been sent overseas earlier?
Well, you know, it's kind of like people say it was preordained. Mm-hmm. Well, you can argue that everything is preordained because you can't prove it. Mm-hmm. So I'd have to say, yeah, preordained.
And the other thing, you'd gone in pretty early, 1942, right? The war is still pretty young. And a lot of guys I've talked to were kind of itching to get overseas and fly some combat missions. How did you feel about that? Was that something that motivated you? Were you comfortable staying stateside? Or do you remember having any kind of preference or emotion about that?
I was hoping that, yeah, when I got my orders, I said, oh, gee, I wonder where I'm going now. You know, I was looking, hoping that I was going someplace. And then when I saw a report back to Pensacola, well, that was the one turning point in my life, because I could have gone on, if I'd have gone on in, I had a better chance of getting killed over there than I did at Pensacola, because one chance that I remember that I never told anybody about it, because I knew if I had told somebody, there would have been a definite change in things. Because I was following, back there we had instruction, you know, to go out with an instructor. And then when they were soloing, we would put them in flying in formation, three planes and with a chase plane. And I was flying a chase plane, and the flight was over, so we was going back to the base, observe what they did right and what they did wrong. And all of a sudden, I found that my right rudder was all the way in, but I was still flying straight. Now, if the rudder was working right, that should have given a skew to it, see, but, you know, straight as it could be. So I would wander off a little, but I had the tab wheel over here that I could bring it back. And I'd hit this one, it wouldn't go. I'd kick that one, it'd go. And I was going down with my rudders like this. That's not right. I said, well, what in the world am I going to do? Because just a mile down the road, I'm going to circle and I've got to land. I got to do something. So I knew that if I went up and told the tower that I was having this problem, somebody would come up in a plane and look at it and said, but I could control it with my stick and my, over here, my wheel. I could fly it okay. So I said, well, if I tell it, they're going to look up at it. Then they're going to call the tower. The tower's going to call the commander. And the commander's going to call the main station. And the main station is going to tell, well, ditch it in the bay. Well, I did not want to go into the bay, because with those extended wheels, there's a good chance to fly it upside down. And if I don't say anything, I can control it with my tab wheels and the stick okay. And if I wreck it, well, I'm in trouble. I knew I was going to be in trouble either way. One way or the other, I had, you know, I was all right. I was just making it worse. I said, well, I'm going to stick my neck out. I'm going to fly it in. So I come on around, I lined it up, you know, and come on down, right in there. And just as it hit the ground, boom, back to normal. And I come on in, this is nothing had happened. Now, had I told them and they made me ditch that in the bay, why, that would have been too, and they always try to find out what's wrong, and nothing's wrong. So, yeah, you just did it for fun. Well, no, I never do anything fun if I'm going to do that. And I think what it was, that somewhere the cable had slipped off of the wheel, and the jar made it pop back on. And this is you the first one I've ever told this to. So I dodged a bullet that day.
And this was in the SNV, is that what you were flying?
I was flying the intermediate. It was an SNV, but I don't know who made it, and I don't know what it's the name I was using.
But it had fixed landing gear.
Yeah, it had fixed landing gear.
And that was part of your concern about having to ditch in the water, was that would leave you upside down, and that could that have cost you your life?
Well, it could have. I mean, you know, life is a mystery.
But you've never told anybody this all these years.
You're the first one I ever told it to.
Well, thank you for sharing, and I want to make sure I understand it. So as you're calculating this all in your mind, you really don't have any good options, and you don't know if that rudder's ever going to work right again, but you figure between the throttle control and the trim tab, you can bring it in?
That's right, yeah. But I know even though I could control it, if I told them there was no way they was going to let me try that.
They would have said, out of precaution, go ahead and ditch it.
Yeah, go ahead and put it in the water.
And that, I'm glad you brought that up, because I've heard a lot of stories about training flights that did end up in the water. So, and a lot of people don't think about that. We think about the casualties overseas. We don't hear a lot about the casualties stateside. Were there guys that you knew or things that you witnessed or heard about where people lost their lives or were injured in some of those training flights at the places you were?
I know that on the same station there at Ellison Field, the moving airplane has the right-of-way. Everything is all painted out, crosswalks and so forth. Okay, if airplane is coming and you're going to the crosswalk, you're going to wait until the airplane passes. Well, this day, this cadet, I don't know what he was thinking about. He had his parachute and everything, and there's a plane coming, and he just walked right in front of it. Cost him his arm. He was just lucky it didn't kill him.
And you said something a minute ago, too. You know, had you gone overseas instead of going back to Pensacola, that you might have been in more dangerous duty, more in harm's way. Who knows what might have happened to you? Out of all the aircraft that you got to fly, was there one that you appreciated the most, that you enjoyed flying the most?
The one for actual joy was the Stearman. It's a little bitty biplane, you know, for training and everything. Yeah, you can have more fun with that than you can flying the four engine. You can't do much barrel rolls on that.
The privateer, we didn't touch on it too much, what it was like to fly. And you talked about those white cap missions.
It was just like flying a B-24, because all it was, they just took the B-24 and made those adjustments. They took their double tail off and put that monstrosity on back there.
You weren't a fan of the single tail?
Well, all I did was fly them. I didn't have anything to do about designing them, so I don't know. But I had crew of 12. Oh, there's another one that I must tell you. This happened out of Jacksonville, Florida. The Navy said the crews could not have mascots. No way, no mascots. Well, at that time, we were flying B-24s. When you're landed, the belly of the B-24 is only about a foot and a half above the ground. So to enter it, you have to open the bomb bay doors, step on the little track they have between the two bomb bays, and then up into the cockpit. That's the only way you can get other than crawl out the window. So this one crew, there's always one that's going to bust the They had a small goat, a little bitty goat, you know. And he's got where he knew him, see? So when they landed, every time they opened the bomb bay, it made a noise. And the goat learned that noise, so he was always the first one off. So they would, you're laughing, you know what's happened. So when they went on a trial run out to drop depth charges, but while they were out there, when they got ready to make their run, they opened the bomb bay door. The little goat heard the noise. Hey, we are home. Dived right in the ocean.
I guess that's why you don't have mascots. Well, most of the people listening to this weren't alive for World War II, and it's hard for them to wrap their brain around what it was like. Is there something you think we need to understand about you and all the other Americans alive then and what they did and why it still matters now?
Yeah, well, it'll have to get political if we will just use the brains the good Lord gave us and quit messing around and saying that I am better than you are and work together. That's what the country needs, because we're coming into another situation just like the Great Depression, and I'm afraid it's going to be a lot worse.
And is that what you saw the country do in the 1940s, come together?
A lot more so than they are now. And right now, I feel that nobody is moving in the same direction with anybody else. You know, it's ridiculous.
Is there something when you kind of look back over 100 years that you have the most gratitude for, that you're the most thankful for, the most satisfied with?
Well, I'd have to say that the thing that I'm the most proud of is my family. I have five wonderful kids, and they're all grown, and they've got kids of their own who've got kids of their own, but they'll always be my kids. I'm thankful for that.
Have you ever wondered how different your life would have been if you didn't join the Navy?
I do it all the time. I wonder, well, now, I'm kind of like Yogi Berra. When you come to a fork in the road, take it. I don't know how it worked out, but I think it worked out the way that it was supposed to have worked out.
And anything else about your wife? I mean, what are the odds you're going to meet your wife as your Link trainer instructor?
You know, to tell her the truth, I don't know what she saw in me enough to marry me in the first place. She saw something. I don't know. If she'd had her eyes checked before, I might have not got her. I don't know.
She must not have had a very good optometrist.
No, she didn't.
But no, she married one.
Yeah, she is. I can't say enough about her because just like a team of horses, you know, work together. Well, that's the way we were.
Well, I know there's one thing I forgot to say. I forgot to say thank you. Thank you for serving our country and for telling us your story.
I'm glad to do it. Yeah.
World War II Navy pilot Gilbert Stocks, now reunited above with his late wife, Iva Dawn, after his final breath on Earth came at age 104. We're just about out of time on Hometown Heroes today, but one final thank you before I sign off. Dr. Stocks is one of nearly 2,300 veterans who visited their memorials in Washington, D.C. with Central Valley Honor Flight. That's part of the Honor Flight Network, something you can connect with wherever you live. Where I live, in the heart of California, many of you stepped up last week to donate to make sure an honor flight hoping to take 70 veterans to our nation's capital this October would not have to be postponed. So I just want to say thank you, thank you, thank you on behalf of all the veterans who are going to benefit. And thanks for listening to Hometown Heroes today. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by Provident Payments. Give your business the edge only their personalized service can deliver at providentpayments.com.